This episode is sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. More on their services later in the show.
Hi, welcome to Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vinson. Hello, Will.
Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Today we've got with us Florian Apollinar, who's a long-time Django contributor, former security team member, former steering council member, everything, and yet somehow still so young. Florian, thank you for coming on the show.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, no, I'm really excited to have you. Go on, Will, go on.
I was just going to ask, so you've kind of already lived the life that Carlton's just stepped into now. Like, what do you know that he doesn't?
I don't think I know anything he doesn't, but I probably had the pleasure of starting earlier, right? So,
well, maybe let's start with that, because you are, for those who can't see you, you are still quite young, especially given how long you've been involved with Django. When did you first start with Django? How did that happen?
So I think it was around 2006 or 2007. It was quite early. I think the famous magic removal branch had mostly just happened. So given it a long time ago, I can't remember the old code anymore. I know I saw a bit of it, but I know Django like it is nowadays, which speaks a bit to its backwards compatibility, right?
Right.
And
so how did a young person find it in 2006? What was it, or 2007? What was it that led you to Django?
So my father.
Because you work. Let me just rephrase that, because you're not based in Lawrence, Kansas, okay? Lawrence, Kansas.
No, so I am not.
How on earth?
No. My father is based is working in IT. As a programmer, and it is for medical clinics and stuff like that. So not web frameworks, but internal clinic systems. And I was always impressed. I liked playing Age of Empires 1 at the company computers and so.
You love a big screen.
Small screens. There were no big screens at the time. At some point, I wanted to do what my father did, namely programming. And so we started to look for a project that we could do, because I'm really a bad learner. If I learn something just for the sake of it, I need a reason to do something, right? And our idea was to write a cookbook software where we could put in our dishes and recipes. And we started doing this with, I think, Turbo Gears. I'm not sure if you ever used it. And used at the time Xul. This was the XML user interface Mozilla used quite a long time for Firefox, where you could create native looking user interfaces in the browser, which was kind of nice. I'm kind of sad that they dropped it. And so we started working on this application. And at some point, we became bored or so and looked around what there are other options, and then we found Django. And from that point on, it was Django.
So if in doubt, rewrite it from scratch. Is that the...
absolutely. I think Turbo Gears wasn't even, maybe not even the first implementation. So there were like three implementations. I think we actually rewrote it every year, and then at some point... we got bored rewriting. And this was the time, I think, around 2006 or so, when I met Armin Ronacher. He lived, near me, 100 kilometers or something. And we met at the bar camp, and he was working on Ubuntu Users, which is the German Ubuntu platform. And we had, or they at the point in time, had a software containing of... PHBBB, the burning board software, MoinWiki, which was Python-based already, and something self-written, a news portal in Django. And they were already rewriting it completely to Django, and at this point I joined. And I think it's one of the largest and oldest Django deployments still running in Germany.
And that's probably open source as well. So if people are looking for a long-lived open source Django application to study from, they could perhaps use that.
Yeah, but this is actually not open source. So we never got around it. I also was against releasing it, to be honest, because we didn't know what we were doing, right? And the code evolved. Yeah. We had our own user model. We had everything, and it took us a while till we could switch to the user model or the abstract user model Django provided. We had our own, I don't know, caching before Django got those caching options. So release after release, we worked hard to port over to modern Django and, yeah, modernize the whole stack.
Okay, well, you said user model, which is was like my thing for last year. So I'm curious if you could, what do you make of the current status of the Django user model? And do you have any thoughts on, because there's a number of proposed changes to it. How do you feel about all that?
I don't know. I'm a bit torn. I see the recommendations is like always start with a custom user model, but I also
not anymore. Carlton got that taken out of the docs.
No. All it was a very small change I made. It's like
highly recommend.
It got rid of the really scary warnings that the world was going to end if you didn't.
I'm sorry that I mentioned that. We've been sort of like silent, not intentionally not talking about that for like half a year now, Carlton. But the change has been out there.
No, come on, Florin, finish the quick. What do you think? I mean, if you think as we're going forward, what's the best story?
I think the story is kind of okay. What I would like to see more in terms of business applications is actually support for OpenID Connect, at which point the user model becomes a little bit more, well, irrelevant. What I see, what I use it currently still for is that like I'm syncing the groups that, or rather I get roles from OpenID Connect and then automatically create groups in Django for that and assign permissions and so on to that. So all I need basically is some user model. I don't think I even fill the first name and last name. I just
it's get just it out the foreign key.
Yeah. And for display, you get something from OpenID Connect anyways, and you can put that into the session in the worst case, or have an extra model where you store the extra data. It's one extra query compared to, well, I don't know, the work maintaining the custom user model or so. It's simply not worth it for my use cases, but I'm mostly doing internal applications, and you can tell users there that, well, it is like it is, and we are not going to change anything.
Okay, so I was thinking about what you talk about OpenID Connect there. It's just sort of one option in the auth world. And I think there's lots of people that have come on the podcast and lots of conversations we've had on the forum and place about how we need to sort of bump up. Django's auth story is solid and it's good, but things like 2FA, things like, you know, third-party auth providers and whatnot. I've been thinking about that recently because we could take on some sort of mega project and try and merge everything into core, or we could at least for a first pass try and like document the ecosystem options out there. And what's your sort of take? How do you think we can move forward in this space? Because, you know, it's difficult for us to bring everything into core because we just don't have the capacity to maintain things.
Yeah. So I guess this is one of the main problems because like there's OpenID Connect, but it's standardized, right? But it's like you have login with Google, you have login with Microsoft, and depending on the directory provider, you don't get back a username, but like a domain name, which is display name, which looks ugly, and KeyClock gives you the full name and whatnot. So I'm not sure. I think we should look out a little bit just because we're using it at work. Is Java and the Spring ecosystem. And they have relatively good support from what I gather, what the developers are telling me, that they can easily like add OpenID Connect to an application and it all basically works. And I haven't looked at that because I'm not a developer anymore, but I guess we should take more inspirations from other frameworks, be that Spring or Rails, Ruby on Rails, OmniAuth, which GitLab uses, and maybe see what they use and then draw the conclusions from there.
Try and rob some ideas from places.
Yeah, because it's not like it's not I mean, it's a solved problem, right? At least for some things. You always will need extra templates probably because like you want to put login with Google at the first position or something like that. And I would question whether it makes sense to have this all in code or just ask the user to reorder things, reshuffle things in a template. It's also like, yeah. Do you support just one authentication provider, which is typical for an internal enterprise application, or do you go software as a service and need to support based on like the email domain of your username, different IDPs? It's a different health story.
Right, and too complex for Django to have one simple answer for everybody, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, one good thing is that Raymond Penner is with Django Auloth. He's doing a lot of really great work kind of pushing all this forward without the community needing to get involved. So that's a positive thing. Like he got a grant and he's already done a bunch, but I think I just use Django Auloth, honestly, and it has most of the things I need at this point.
I do as well, but it required quite a bit of tinkering around. If I remember correctly, it reads the role from the user info endpoint, and our IDP per default gives it in the access token or in the ID. I think in the ID token. So, and it's not really well documented where from it gets the roles or extra attributes, which makes it a bit hard. But generally, I think it's the best option currently. But you have to dig into the code, especially if you want to do more than just login, because what's very important for us is that we get some kind of roles that we then can map to permissions on our side.
You mentioned you're not really a developer anymore. Can you expand upon that?
Yeah, so I'm mostly doing system administration nowadays. The funny part of the story is that when I started at the current company, I actually got or was forbidden to do any code. The idea behind was that we actually need a system administrator way more than another developer, and to ensure that the priorities are set straight, I was not allowed to code, which was mostly in jest, but still holds kind of true. So
you'd sneak back late one night just to get a couple of lines in, right?
No, I actually am currently sneaking back and writing my own Django application for some internal tooling. But I mean, that's like, I think 7 or 8 years in.
But what is that world like, right? Clearly it's engaging enough to keep you occupied. I'm thinking about silos in the context of, I've been very much head down in the web space and I'm doing a DjangoCon talk on Django and data science because, you know, data science is a thing that I know very little about. So I'm curious, someone who knows both Django and then, you know, let's just pick on system administration. What do you see as the similarities and differences between the two? I mean, it's all programming, but it's a totally different world.
I don't think it's a different world, actually.
I
actually like to see more people getting involved into system administration and coding at the same time, because there are so many things like you have to think about your software from a different perspective, right? If I'm getting handed down software from the developers and I'm putting it into production, I need some kind of conventions, be that like this, we have config files or we pass it in via environment variables, and you need useful log lines, especially if you don't speak the language the program is written in, which can happen as well, or usually is the case if you're a normal system administrator. And I think software development can, or in both direction, we can learn from each other, because there are like this structured thing for a system administrator where you say you want your log lines all in the same format, independent of like whether I have 10 applications or 20. This makes also sense for a developer, because they are faster when all their programs output the same log format. It's easier to recognize patterns if you don't have to focus on every new log line and guess the format and so on.
This idea was, I know like the term now has just become a sort of hostage to marketing, but this was the idea behind the DevOps movement, you know, originally, right? It was that if you get developers closer to ops, they can think with an ops mindset and vice versa.
Yeah. I honestly don't like DevOps as such, because the idea was there, I think, but in the end it turned somewhere. So it's like nowadays it sometimes feels like you don't know enough from either world.
Right.
And I think it's better to have like a developer who's interested in operations and a system administration who is administrator who is interested in development. But you can accept that you don't wear both hats. I mean, in smaller companies, it's often happening, right? But yeah. This distinction still makes sense, but you have to look over the border and see what the rest of the company is doing. You don't want those silos.
Right. So it's not like, right, I've written it, now you deploy it. No, I'm not going to deploy it, throw it back over the wall several times.
That's
obviously not healthy.
It's especially when it comes to like configuration management, where we're using Ansible quite a lot. You have to think about how to handle secrets, and you need to support from the developers. They need to adjust, in the worst case, the application, depending on whether you are reading the secret from, I don't know, Vault, or using a HSM for hashing or signing stuff. Yeah. This completely changes how you work, because quite often you can't use a few libraries. Because like they make the assumption that you always have access to the private key, which if the private key is not on your system, is not going to work.
So there's talk in the Django world. There's talk in the Django world about trying to do something to smooth the road from. So the start project template is very beginner friendly. It's very, you know, get up and running, but it's not. There's quite a number of steps to get to production, to get to deployment. It's like a big challenge that people have. And one of the questions is about secret handling and whether we can build in better handling of environment variables, or, you know, have you got any thoughts about, you know, if we could do something in that space, what would you like to see?
Hard topic. Where to even start? So I'm using, I think, Django GoodConf, which gives me all this environment handling, which works nicely. But as soon as you start to integrate secret management systems, especially with rotating secrets, it becomes really, really hard. Like if you think about our database backends, you can't really, I mean, you can if you overwrite the database backend, but like you can't change the password every 5 minutes. And same goes for service discovery. Like a new connection should always resolve via console or something. This is really hard. The Django settings module works best with static credentials. And I'm not a fan of environment variables. I try to get rid of them as far as possible, because
you're going to explain why. Yeah.
Yeah. So the reason is we are doing mostly Java, and in Java it's not that bad, because you do have your virtual machine, basically. So the Java virtual machine, and there are usually no program forks or anything. But if you're using Django and having a Python project, it can happen that you, I don't know, call out to some sub-process. And this sub-process automatically inherits all the environment variables by default, usually. I mean, there might nowadays be some options, and Python nowadays also closes, for instance, open file descriptors by default. But in the earlier days, this all got inherited to the sub-process. And especially if you're using the sub-process for things like rendering a PDF file or something, and you got an exploit there, you have access to all your secrets. And I think every remote code execution that I know tries to look for secrets via environment variables, because that's, since Heroku, I think Heroku was it with the 12 factor stuff, popularized it really, really hard. And now, you know, if you are inside a process, you have environment variables. And if you put all those things into files, it's way more, you have to figure out where the file is. I mean, it's not exactly hard, but if you take more off the shelf stuff, and depending on the system, the environment variables are leaking around everywhere. I mean, as the same user, you can always look them up in the proc file system on Linux, which is kind of okay. I mean, that's how it's designed and it works like that, right? But a file is easier, I think.
It's too much space for exploits.
Yeah. And also, good luck trying to encode, I don't know, a list or something, or a hash map or any structure in environment variables where you see ugly solutions where you then have _123456 and pass through that, or JSON encode and put a prefix in and it's like, ah.
Okay, so here's my question, because my sort of follow-up to that, because I think when people are starting out and they just hard code the credentials in the settings file, that's clear, a step to move to environment variables is clearly a step up. But then there's a step beyond environment variables for the reasons you've talked about, because they're not the securest thing in the world. And I think any solution that we have in Django needs to account for the evolution along that pathway, right? It needs to have backends for, you know, proper vault systems as well as environment handling.
But I think once you have a generic backend, you get all that for free. The main question that you usually have to answer is, how does this backend work, right? Do you read up all environment variables at startup, or do you access the environment once the variable is accessed? Because this at some point begs the question, do you have a schema and can read all the needed data in advance? Or if you need to go to an outside system, does that mean an HTTP call for every variable when it's first read? Or can you like in bulk read the whole configuration? And this is where it gets interesting and hard, I think.
And this is why every time we have a discussion about it, we never make any progress.
Yeah, but I mean, most config systems I know out there for Django already support files and environment variables in some form. And usually you can mix and match them. One thing I ran recently into was I wanted to run systemd inside a Docker container and use that to start my application, because I'm trying to ship my application as a single container. And this really easily breaks down if you use environment variables, because systemd won't start your service with the environment variables that you passed into the container by default. And so if your application just reads a config file, it's readable from everywhere for your application, and you don't have to think about whether it started via systemd and are the environment variables passed down or not. And
but systemd's got this credentials thing that you're meant to use, aren't you, with that? Ram it in there.
Yeah, I haven't tried it inside containers, to be fair.
Okay. But okay.
We are currently playing with it. It actually solves a bit of problems for us, because you can store the credential as the root user on the system and then provide it to the service, and then it has access. And in combination with containers, you get very interesting and great deployment patterns. For instance, we are also using socket activation, like in a D style. And so we have our containers without network access, but they provide an HTTP API to the outside world, which is perfect, because you can now execute some code that might call out to the outside world, like any document, literally, like printing an HTML page or something, which could include an image. And this is all blocked by default because the container has no network. And I think systemd provides some nice deployment units in that sense.
Okay. So go on, Nemo.
No, you go. Keep going.
Okay. So I was going to ask, like, so you're right into the world, you're right into deployments, you're using quite advanced containerized whatnots and Kubernetes, I guess, and what, I don't know, yeah. Not Kubernetes, right?
Not
so Kubernetes. I was going to ask, what are your favorite things from that landscape? Of all the tools that come by, what are the ones that you think, yeah, no, that really makes a difference?
So we are using Ansible a lot, really, really a lot, basically for everything. We are slowly evaluating Kubernetes. I'm impressed by what I'm seeing there, but I'm also kind of afraid. Like, we need to understand our systems, and so just for context, the company I'm working at is a trust center, which is under the EIDAS regulations, where we concern ourselves with digital signatures and whatnot. And we basically have an uptime of 100%, so 99.999 something or so for the last 5 years. And this includes basically maintenance and everything. And we are really, really afraid of systems that we don't understand. And I like the fact that you can put a database onto Kubernetes and the operator, so they have this operator pattern, which will upgrade and make backups and everything. But what happens when the operator goes wrong? Sure, it's better tested than your usual setup, but when it goes wrong, you have to fix it anyways.
Yeah, and the problem with the high nines, the uncommon problems become problems, right? They happen.
Yeah. And so we keep it really simple as much as possible. So we have Ansible, we can deploy a new virtual machine in minutes or actually seconds, what it takes to clone it, basically. After that, Ansible runs over it, and usually that's it. So we get certificates issued, everything automatically, and then we can use the machine. And it's not like we don't need to scale that much. So we have a rather static setup, and it's questionable how much Kubernetes makes sense there, right? I mean, for some things, certainly in the future, but I still think that Docker Compose per se is a nice deployment pattern, because it allows you to put things together nicely with all its ups and downs, like the network routing and everything. But no matter what you use, right, you have to know the stack. You have to own it if you want to be successful. So that means providing patches to Docker Botman as well and digging in really deep.
Hacksoft is your development partner beyond code. From custom software development to consulting, team augmentation, or opening an office in Bulgaria, they're ready to take your project to the next level. I want to ask you so you run the security team for Django, and Django is well known for having one of the best security stories out there, but that's very much behind the veil because people submit them privately and they're handled. I'm curious, I'm sure there were some wild stories especially early days, security issues.
I don't think that we had really, really bad security issues, right? Mostly it's like denial of service, quite often via regular expressions or something. Mm. And I guess the worst thing that we had, which was only in the main branch at the time, when we moved the login view to class-based views, or was it the password reset view, you were able to reset a password for any user without the password reset link, basically. It was really a subtle change, but that was horrifying. I wouldn't have wanted that on a live site, right?
Yeah. Well, but I mean, Carlton, you're still on it, Carlton?
Yeah, I'm still on the security team, yeah. I'm hanging on in there for now.
I mean, if I think of things that are important but completely hidden, security team is up there, right? So
yeah, the one that comes to mind was GitHub had a password hijack thing with Unicode encoding of emails, lookalike emails of Unicode.
Oh
ones.
Yeah, and
they
remember
they
that.
Published
yeah.
They published a blog post about how they'd fixed it in Rails, And Simon Charette was reading his, you know, with his coffee and his RSS reader, pinging them a security list. Like, hey, folks, I think we need to do something about this. And we all have a quick look. We're all like, oh, yes. And then so a hot fix went out, I think, the very next day. And normally Django has the 7-day pre-announcement and to tell people that the security fix is coming. But on that one, it was like, look, because this has been made public and it was quite a serious vulnerability. As Florian says, most of them are kind of denial of service ones, which they're worth fixing, but they're questionable to whether an individual installation is going to get hit. This is kind of like a much more serious one. And it was like, no, we've got to drop the 7-day advance and just put it out as fast as we can. That's the one that comes to mind as the sort of most pressing from my time on it.
And I mean, that also goes a little bit back to looking at what other frameworks are doing, because especially with security issues, we are fixing the same security issue in a multitude of frameworks, especially when you look at Flask or so. If Flask has an issue in its HTTP handling, I bet Django has it as well, and also in the other direction. I mean, it's happened once or twice, I think. And same goes for PHP and Ruby. And this is something with all this, security posture going around nowadays with we need software inventories and whatnot. What we first need is to talk with each other and find a common channel where we can easily exchange security issue classes, basically, where they like, we've got this kind of problem. Can you look if you also have it? Because chances are that most systems have it. And sometimes you see it in the published issues that day after day, a new framework joins the the release process and says, oh, we have the same issue. And this is something which would be great to work on, but it's really hard to get like multi-language programs started, right?
Yeah, or even multi-framework. It's difficult enough to, you know, David Lord has reached out to us a few times and we are in communication with Flask and David over there. But it's difficult enough to handle sort of our own reports because a lot of them, you know, there's a lot of traffic to the security list. And so it's like, okay, we need to stay on top of that as well as reaching out as well. And is there a common space? No, there isn't. I mean, I wonder if we can get something going with Python and, you know, with Seth doing such a good job there, if he could nerd herd us into the same room.
It's nothing $2 million and a dozen full-time employees can't solve.
Yeah, exactly. So, Lauren, so you said you were still working on your internal application at with Django. Yeah. Okay, so after all this time, what keeps you fresh? What keeps you staying with Django? Is it just that you know it, or are there bits that you think, no, that's what I mean?
Well, part of it is certainly that I know it. I don't have the time to play around and learn a new framework just to write an application for internal use. And the other thing is, what I still like about Django is that even though it's sometimes horrible to work with, you get everything out of one hand, right? You don't have to explain to someone using Django how forms and models interact. And I don't need so many extensions or dependencies in that sense. The current project has like, I think, 5 or so. And this is massive for me, especially this is by no means anything against Flask or so, but when I need login, I know I can count on Django to some extent, right? There's no open ID connect, like we said, but I've got that covered. I've got form validation covered. I've got models. I don't need to think about how to integrate SQL Alchemy, which I love and think is way, way, way superior than the Django ORM in some senses. And the same goes true for Flask itself. But it's like this thing where you have everything out of one hand and you have one documentation to look at. You have one channel for support where you don't get told to, this is not a problem with the form handling, but it's with the models.
Yeah, so different repo, yeah.
This other channel, because this is all a different company or something like that.
Okay. Okay, so that one hand, that battery's included, I guess you could. If you think about the scope of Django as it is now, and thinking about this from, you know, we constantly add things, but do we ever take anything out? Are there bits that you think we could retire from core or take out of core or separate? And contrary to that as well, are there bits that you think, no, actually, I'd like to bring that in and that's missing from my deck?
So for me, it's most certainly the low-level tooling like authentication, configuration, and there was a third one. But this I would like to see in core and more of it, but I have never used the Sites framework, for instance, but it's hard to throw stuff out. I understand that, but all in all, I think the scope should stay roughly. I also wouldn't want to add too much support, for instance, for HTMX. I know plenty of people are using it, but it's still like it feels like new. It's great. Some people are using something else, and maybe in 3 years we are back to somewhere else. But this is especially an area where we can experiment outside. And you know, when we added for I think it was template partials where you needed something to make it work. This has been the story for Django all along, right? What's the minimal thing we can do to enable you to implement your ideas? And in this case, it's two lines, and you can build Django template partials, which offers much, much more flexibility. But what you needed in core was one line. I understand that this doesn't work for stuff like authentication, or not always, where I say like, yeah, I would feel better if I don't have like 10 libraries of glue code. I want one security solution and want that to work.
Do you have any thoughts on UV? I see you have a repo on it. Have you had a chance to play around with that at all?
I've converted pretty much everything to it.
Okay, so that's a yes, yeah.
Yes, but not... Well, how to put it? Everyone is complaining every time that packaging in Python doesn't work, which, like, I guess is or was true to some extent. But for me, it's how to put this? It's like writing a web application without knowing HTTP, right? You can use Django without knowing HTTP, but you have a much better understanding of it if you know that HTTP is supposed or is stateless, and what this means, when you should use get, when you should use post, and what the implications of that are. So for me, UV is mostly useful in the sense that I'm getting a single binary that I can easily include in my Docker files, in my intermediate build containers, without having to install much, and from that on let UV take over. But similarly, I had the same thing with Poetry and PDM. I think I'm switching my package manager for Python yearly, so
okay. But I'm in but the other school every 20 years.
Well, we had Hinnick on recently, and he's fully on board with UV, and I think when I ask around, most people who've tried it are like, yeah, this is certainly for the foreseeable future, this is the way to do it.
Well, and what's helping me currently is that they are maybe because they are funded, or just because they are funded, there is a really, really quick turnaround on issues. And while I understand that stuff doesn't move fast in open source, it's like when you can't build your project anymore because some new package got released somewhere which breaks the dependency resolving of your package manager, and it's not like resolving packages is an easy task, right? So it's not something I can fix even if I want it. And it really helps to get a quick turnaround there. And even if it's like with some stop hatches to explicitly tell the package manager, use just this package. I don't care whether it works on Windows or not. I don't care if it works on a Mac. I just want it to work in this specific Docker container. And this is my deployment unit. It's great that it doesn't resolve for, I don't know, CUDA and whatever GPU stuff you have nowadays, but That's not what I need.
Have you looked into it closely enough to see into the sort of the performance enhancements? Because I think, whilst it's obviously written in Rust, but I think most of the enhancements are just because it's cleverer about how it searches for packages, and it's more aggressive about caching and things like that. I wonder if you know anything about whether those speed gains can be brought into, say, PIP or, like, you know, the community tools.
I do think so, because PDM actually uses the resolver, or users can use UV for resolving nowadays. So it's certainly doable, but I'm not sure if the resolver itself, the resolver certainly plays part in it, but I'm just guessing. I haven't profiled it, but what I do know is that there is aggressive, really, really aggressive caching going on, to the extent, like, when your package is installed and it's installed in editable mode, and it then gets put into the cache with an explicit version, and which means your later log files will then include this version instead of your project, so instead of your dev version. I mean, that got fixed, but there are we are moving to caching bugs now in UV, so whether that's a good sign or a bad sign, I don't know. But it certainly works, and it works fast. So
okay, cool.
I have a question. This is probably just because I started working at JetBrains, which makes PyCharm IntelliJ. I'm curious, what text editor IDE do you like to use these days, and why?
I guess out of habit, Visual Studio Code. Mm-hmm. I was using Vim for a long time before, but the easy, let's put it that way, the easy integration of auto-completion and everything won me over. I do know that I can do everything with Vim and Emacs as well, but I just don't care. Especially if I'm using Vim on servers, usually Vim is one of the editors installed on some servers. Not those necessarily that we manage, but I had my fair share working with other servers, and you'd have a default configuration there. And once you use Vim on your local laptop and connect to a server, and the configuration is different there, it stops becoming viable. This is one of the reasons I don't want the editor that I use unconfigured with the default settings for system administration also be my programming environment. And Visual Studio Code was fast enough. I'm still an unhappy user, so to say, because I'm not going, or I can't justify paying. I could. I don't know what the policies are or if it's possible to pay for it. But with all these Python plugins becoming more and more closed source and the digital rights management stuff around it, I'm not too happy about it. I understand parts of it, but I haven't found a better solution yet. And also, I mean, I know we do use JetBrains here and there, but and correct me if I'm wrong. Last time I looked at it was 10 years ago. But I think it's still like you have one program for one language, and in Visual Studio Code, I have some plugins and it works well enough, and I'm switching between 5 languages a day, so I wanted the consistency.
That's a common thing out there. There is some truth in it. I think it's not totally true. For example, if you use PyCharm for Python, it also pulls in WebStorm, which has support for JavaScript, TypeScript, HTML, CSS. So, you know, if you want to hop over to Java, can't do that as easily. So there's, I think JetBrains doesn't talk about that, the bundling, partly because there's the pro and the free version. So it's mostly true. I mean, it's interesting that it's a little bit, VS Code is a little bit like Flask in that it's micro, and then you rely on the community for most of the plugins that you want to use. Whereas JetBrains is a little more like Django. It's all in-house. I mean, under the hood, it's basically the IntelliJ Java engine. So there's like a global engine that drives things, and then there's specific things for PHP or Python or what have you. So it's a little more Django-y. But yeah, the end of the day, that's a common thing people say. And I think if you are bouncing between a lot of languages, like, I certainly understand why you'd want just one IDE for that.
And I mean, for me, it's not, I'm not doing much editing, right? I'm mostly looking at code, but on a normal workday, it's probably Go, Rust, in the worst case, a little bit of C, and then usually some Java and whatever I have with Ansible. So mostly YAML scripts or YAML files. And it's, I mostly need syntax highlighting, and that's about it.
Have you tried Zed at all? That, do you know about this project?
No, I have.
It's from the people who made the Atom editor for GitHub. Will Klopp, who's involved in the Django community, it's public. He just started working there part-time. That's interesting. It's interesting that they're not going 1,000% AI focus yet, the way everyone else is, right? So obviously VS Code is, JetBrains is, Cursor, you know, there's sort of these two extremes of, like, you know, have AI, have full integration, agents and stuff. And then there's also, I just want a text editor IDE with some syntax highlighting that isn't slow, right?
Yeah. And I mean, looking at other things is part of my day job, right? And so if I am to change my personal editor or something, the pain it inflicts on me needs to be really, really high. I just don't have the capacity to change my system and everything every other day, because that's already my day job, right? And I want some consistency in some things that I use.
Just mentioning the AI, I imagine you can't go near it really at work, because you can't risk errors.
I don't know. I'm not involved in those discussions. I actually don't know, aside from coffee table discussions, if there are any. But I honestly don't think it would be a problem, because we would still have code review and everything.
Testing.
It would still be your fault. Not that we assign blame or anything, but you have to take ownership of the code you want to submit. And I think like Simon Wilson is blogging quite a bit about it. It is like with everything. If you know something like Django well, an AI can help you iterate faster. And I'm not sure if it, maybe it was Guido in his early days after joining Microsoft or something like that. It might have not been him, but I have this quote or rough quote in my head where he says, like, you don't need an IDE if you know where everything is, right? And for me, this holds true to some extent, because an IDE doesn't help you find stuff all the time. You still need to know where to go looking. And I see this nowadays with Visual Studio Code. I'm not doing that much Django anymore. So I use the auto-completion, and I need to import a response object or something like that. And I get a completion with 30 response objects. 10 response objects are from sub-projects like Django DRF or Django Ninja, which re-import. And so you still need to know which response object is the correct one for the task, and whether this is just a forward import or if it's a subclass. So yes, use AI by all means. I mean, I would be careful or ask legal whether I can send stuff outside our work perimeter. But in the end, it's a tool like everything. I wouldn't be too afraid of it.
Okay, fair enough.
I was just watching, Guido had an interview with Lex Friedman a couple of years ago on his podcast talking about text editors. And Guido was saying that he used, for a time, he used PyCharm specifically just for the search. But then he would go back into, I forget, Vim or Emacs, something, you know, now VS Code. So there's something around, like, these tools help you find stuff in a huge project, but then you just want something minimal if you know exactly what you're doing. I would also say that that's part of, so I'll just say one more thing, like, you know, if you see a dropdown of 30 imports, that's something that, for example, like PyCharm has a Django integration. So I think in some cases, at least, we do a better job with that. But like, how do we, I'm only a month in, so how do we communicate that? How do you say that, you know, marginally better? it's hard, right? Because we pick a tool, we get used to it, and then especially as you're senior, you don't really want to switch around your tooling that much.
Yeah. And I mean, even whether you're better or not, it honestly doesn't matter. As soon as you're going to say it, you're going to start a flame war because people will find this one edge case where Vim or so performs better. And I'm just not sure if it's worth it. And what came all out for me is that this language server protocol, so all those generic integrations into the editors, which are not always that generic, but those helped a lot. And this is really important for me when I look at a Go project or Rust project where I have literally no idea and I'm able to find sub implementations or references to this piece of code, which is not so fun in Python, which is, I mean, JetBrains has good support there in Java, but with all this dependency injection going on, like you can view all the implementations of an interface, but you still have no idea what you get auto-wired via configuration somewhere. So it's really hard for me, even with the, I don't know what the JetBrains sub IDE for Java is, but I have looked at that at one point and I found everything I needed, but I just didn't know what was actually in use. But that's not JetBrains' fault, right? But if you take an interface, it can be anything.
So I reckon that the main difference there between the different grades of autocomplete you get is the static typing on the languages. So Rust, super, Go, great, Python, not so great. Which leads us naturally into the question of typing in Django. It's come a long way over the last few years, typing, I think, in Python. What are your thoughts on that as we go into 2025? Like, how do we push that forwards?
I'm honestly not sure, but because I think it's an incredible tool. I personally, I'm now at the stage where I would like to see it. I'm not sure how to start, right? Because, for instance, we need to be able to type the low-level objects first and then kind of build up from that. So I don't think that an approach where we just annotate new code is going to be that helpful, especially we would want to have like type checking in CI that verifies that we're using it correctly. And if 90% of the code base are not annotated, I honestly don't know how this is working. So, but that's just me not using typing that much, especially not in Django because it's not there. In my other projects, I do use it, and it is really hard. I have to admit. So whenever you are trying to do something tricky, it sometimes feels like I'm writing C++ again, right? In the sense that in Python, I have this elegant idea. This is done in one line, and then the type checker says, yeah, you can't do that. Yeah, okay, I know I can write it like I would write static code with no extra features. And then my types will work. This is probably a bit unfair to both languages, but for me, it is really hard to get started, especially like when you say Unicode and text, you have like be lenient in what you accept, but you have to be strict on output, like HTML rendering and everything. And this kind of is the same thing here, like in typing. Do you take a list? Do you take an iterable? How far do you go? What happens if you take an iterable and you want to be strict in your output? Then you put a list or something there. But does the iterable convert to list? Probably not, because it can be anything. And
I had a case, so I know some version of Django, let's call it 2.something. Made allowed hosts. It said, no, it has to be. They added a check where allowed host had to be a list. And I'm like, but I've got a project from the old days that has an iterator there and it's just broken. And like, why?
Yeah, that's so certainly type checking is hard. I really see the benefits, especially in smaller projects. At one company where I work, we had like communication with phone systems like in a hotel, guest check in, check out and stuff like that. And those are phone systems from really old age, basically, where you have serial cable updated to Ethernet via a converter and so, and you basically get the raw serial stream over TCP or USB, depending on what you use. And we were writing code against that. And nowadays with Python, and it was really hard for me to write tests for such a thing because the code was async and I tried to write it with this Dance.io approach. But in the end, for some projects, I just can't justify writing the tests. Or, I mean, that's probably not true, but it's really, really hard. And typing there helps a lot. It eradicates a whole class of mistakes, I think. Be that typos. I mean, the IDEs are already good with typos per se, but everything else, like trying to add an integer to a list or something with the wrong operands, this is really, really great. And it shouldn't mean that you don't have to test anymore, but you don't have to test that much, I would say. Because previously you're taking an object basically, and you either have to document very carefully what the function actually takes, or you have to check inside and throw errors, and then you would want to test this. And now you say, okay, but if I say this is a string or something, I rely on the type checker during development that it ensures that it's a string, and then I don't test what happens if I pass in an integer.
Yeah, and with a compiled language, you have that. As soon as it compiles, often it just runs and it, you know, is bug free because you've satisfied the compiler. And the same applies with type checking, right? To a certain extent.
But it's still not easy.
No. Okay. So I've got one more sort of question I want to ask you. As a very long-standing community member, you see where we're at with, you know, discussions and featured requests and, you know, the difficulties we've had pushing Django forward, I think, over the last few years. It's been very stable, but, you know, there's a lot of desire to push Django forward. How do you think we can do that best? What are your sort of, you know, as you watch and as you partake in the conversations, how do you think we can move forward now?
That's one of those where I think I don't have an answer. Part of me not being this active with Django anymore is probably kind of, I wouldn't call it burnout, but it's this inertia that exists where you just can't get anything off the ground because no matter what you suggest, the default setting is no, we are not going to do that. And this is the reason also, on the other hand, why I like programming in Django, because I can rely on it to work like this in 1 year, which makes it really, really hard. One idea that just came to mind literally now, so no idea if it's viable, is to ask other communities like Rails or Spring to talk about exactly this on Django conferences, that they provide their experience, how they managed to move beyond such a point, or maybe they didn't have this point, this problem at all. And this would give us an outside perspective. I think we're doing better recently than we did a year or 2 years ago, especially with the new steering council as well, because I think we need to make choices now. And I'm happy if someone makes those choices, and I whether they align with what I want is not necessarily required. It's just there is a choice and we know this is the path forward. For instance, the async support in Django is something that lingers around with no good path forward, I think, because do we want to add duplicate code for every method? I don't think so. And now we have this code generation idea, and we will see how it turns out. Personally, I'm not using async Django that much, and I'm not sure. maybe for some parts one can use it, but I won't see Django as a general async framework, especially with this handling or how the async code in Python generally looks. I mean, it's not so bad nowadays, but I have bad memories of the callback hells in JavaScript and to some extent in Twisted, which really makes it hard to follow the code. And this is probably because I stayed away from it. And also, I don't need it. For a general purpose homepage, there is no need to serve every view asynchronous. If you, especially with Python 3.13, I mean, it started there, it will get better. And free threading, we finally have the possibility to catch up with our web servers and spawn like 100 threads. And this is what we can handle instead of a few processes.
I love your idea of having someone from the other communities come to a DjangoCon and speak. I mean, for example, we had David Hennemeyer Henson on this podcast early on. My hypothesis would be that if you look at, so Java, Spring, VMware largely runs that. Rails, Ruby on Rails, you know, that's David Hennemeyer Hansen. He largely runs that still. If you look at Laravel, you know, they raised $72 million and one person kind of runs it. You know, that's kind of the difference, is that all these other ones were competing against, you know, Fast API, it's Sebastian in charge. They do have a little bit more of the BDFL. Not they do sort of, they definitely do. So they can move faster, right? So I think the question is, over the long term, what happens when those companies or people want to step down? But, you know, that's, I strongly suspect that's why they can move faster, because there's someone with a profit motive working full time, whereas there's no one in the Django community doing that.
Yeah, and I also don't imagine that Spring or something is going away soon, because there are so many big, really, really big companies using it. So there will always be someone picking it up. If they end up in the same situation as Django, then I don't know, but there's enough incentive and money behind it, I guess.
Well, but if we had, you know, I don't know, if Instagram had decided to like put a ton of money into Django, like it would move faster. It would still be a community, right? Like, so it's more the question of VMware or some for-profit thing that pushes it, as opposed to 100% community.
Would that actually be true? I mean, we always say we do have roughly enough money. I mean, more money would be good, certainly, but we don't really have the best plans to spend it yet. What I could imagine, for instance, is like if Instagram employed relatively early on all of the Django core members and took it over, that we might be in a similar situation like Spring is, because then you would have a clear leadership in that sense. I don't think that money provides this clear goal of where to head next, unless it's coming with the tag like, okay, this money is for improving the ORM to this situation or something like that.
It's an ongoing thing, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've got to say something. Like, I think for me, it's very much... The trouble with having everything in core all together and everything going through core, and everybody wants to get their feature into core, is that everybody's then trying to have one conversation, and it ends up with too many people having the same conversation. And what would, for me, what I'm trying to think of ways without, you know, taking out the ORM, so, you know, you'd have to install that stuff, but find a way where we can just modularize slightly so that there can be three or four conversations going on, which don't all have to go through the same bottleneck. And I don't know quite how we get there, but I kind of feel like we need to do something in that direction.
What the Boost library is doing, it's a C++ library. They have this Git master repo where they have submodules for every submodule, basically. But I think this would be kind of hard for Django, because like the components are so intermingled, and we don't have clear boundaries, right? And we don't want them in the end, because that's what makes Django great, that the form framework integrates so well with the models. And I'm not sure if it gets better if we have more boundaries in between, as little, small, slight they are, but...
Yeah, no, but exactly. So what was the reason you use it? You use it because of that integration, that it is, you know, it's got that Django feel, right?
I think we're basically up on time. Was there anything you wanted to mention or you wanted us to ask you while you have a microphone?
No, I think we've covered quite a lot. Actually, what we didn't talk about, no, we are going to talk about that now, how the start project template looks like, which is what actually brought us in here, right?
Yeah, because we were talking about it on the social medias.
Exactly. And so just as a quick recap, so that there are always those discussions what start project and everything should include or should not include. And I think it depends a little bit on what you're doing, right? We already have start project templates. There is Cookie Cutter and Django and Copia out there, which I really like because it allows you to release new versions of your template and then update existing projects. And you obviously sometimes get conflicts then, but this provides some nice way to actually update your projects without manually reapplying all your changes. And what I'm doing is basically I'm shipping applications, right? I'm not in an area where you say, okay, this is the application, add it to your settings file, and I'm shipping complete application like NetBox or maybe Venueless ships. And what I found useful is that you could just use start project and then immediately add this generated project as installed application into your setting, into your settings file. This solely means, I think at the current point, it means you still have to create an empty models.py file. But aside from that, you're basically pain free. And then you can add further applications on a subdirectory, sub-package basis, because it's way easier for me to have like my current project, for instance, is named Oversight. It's way easier to have an oversight.core application, an oversight.user, an oversight.something application than to think about valid package names for every application. And it's meant to be used together, right? And we have this namespacing and we can use this. And I don't see any reason anymore for this project. A project for me, so in Django speak, is basically a settings file or not even that. The environment module Django settings, the environment variable Django settings module basically defines what your project is, and you can bootstrap everything from that. So that's what I'm using.
Okay, so it's like the single folder, right? The start project folder is the app itself. And yes. I think that's a big step forward, because Will often talks about this with these books, but like you've got the start, that first run experience where you go start project, now start app, now add it to installed apps. Now, which folder am I meant to be in? Which file am I meant to be in? It's just too much going on, right?
And it would make tutorials quite a bit easier, I think. I mean, we would change the start project template probably to account for that, so not just add the application to the project to installed applications, but also like provide a dummy models.py and tests.py, which we don't use. And maybe, I don't know, I'm sometimes moving the whiskey module into a sub package then, because it's a little bit ugly on the top level, right? But that's whatever you prefer.
I mean, I think for, especially for newcomers, I have a open source thing called Lithium now that was Django X that basically just gives you Django all auth and a little bit of config. But if you had, it'd be nice if there was an official, you know, bootstrapped blog or CRUD with auth or, right, there's only two or three kind of things people want. And if there was, you know, start project gave you that, that would certainly up the learning curve. And then of course the big one would be have production, right, where you default to production, and you'd probably need to use environment variables, but have a way to do that. You know, if I could go work on Django for like a year, I would add those happily and just put them in, because I think that would help newcomers for sure.
I mean, I started doing that with a copier template where you could provide in. So copier asks you a few things on startup and you can define those questions and like, do you want a Bootstrap template? Do you want this JavaScript integration? So basically provide a kitchen sink Django template. I stopped doing that because when I'm using Django, I use this one CSS framework. I use this one JavaScript library. And I think in all those generics, there's lots to be lost because with all this flexibility, there comes much more complexity. And so we probably need like 10 or 15 start project default templates.
Well, if we were, you know, and if we were Laravel, we'd just charge for them, you know, so.
Right. But there are, I think there are also some Django software as a service templates where you click together, like I want to include authentication, I want to include Vault for secrets management and everything. And they are selling. I don't know how well or something, but certainly an area to look at. I'm not exactly sure about the business model because.
Well, it's. I mean, Corey Zhu has SaaS Pegasus. He's, I believe, working on that full time. So that's working. Then there's a dozen other ones I could name that do similar iterations. My sense is that it seems people want the SaaS integration more than they want the rest of it.
Right. But like once you download the code, probably licensing is stopping you from using it for another project. But you get the ideas, right, how such a thing is built after you paid for the first one. So I don't necessarily see it scaling that well inside one company that you can sell it many times, but I'm happy to be proven wrong. And if it works for him, it's perfect because that's certainly something we miss.
Well, we're going over time. I think it's an education thing. People use, I mean, this has been done in other frameworks where people use a SaaS starter thing in Rails to get going and then fill in the details. I think it works a lot like that actually for people, but yeah, I don't know exactly.
let me just finish this topic. There is a depth that we're hopefully going to push forward in the 6.0 or 1 timescale to update the start project template, make it a bit simpler in the along the lines you've talked about there, Florian. And then also as part of that, try to promote using templates a little bit more to make it more obvious to people that you know, there are these templates out there and you can create your own one. And, you know, then maybe we can have 2 or 3 or 4 simple example apps that like, oh yeah, look, there's a blog, there's a wagtail example, there's a who knows what.
Yeah, hopefully it's just the templates currently are a little bit hard to use. If you use non-standard files, you have to include it in the command, and that's what Copier gave me. And it's like reinventing the wheel. Why improve Django in this direction if you can use Cookie Cutter or Copier? I don't know, maybe use something else.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a good point.
We probably will leave it at that and hash it out.
Yes, let's do that. So, Florian, thank you for coming on. When we first started this podcast, you were one of the names we wanted to have on, and 6 years later, here you are.
We finally did it.
Yeah, I'm good at escaping those things.
So. Yeah, well, that's probably why you're productive. So again, thank you for making the time. We'll have links to everything in the show notes, djangochat.com, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Yeah. See you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
This episode was sponsored by Hacksoft, your Django development partner beyond code. Learn more about their services in the link in the description.